This is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to the program. China's president had a four-day state visit to the UK this week, which both leaders in the UK and also Xi Jinping himself have described as the state of a golden era for the relationship. Chinese President Xi Jinping is certainly getting the royal treatment. Him and his wife stayed at Buckingham Palace as guests of the Queen. Both countries want closer ties, but the issue of human rights is again causing problems for the host. Europe correspondent Lisa Miller reports from London.
There was pomp and pageantry and protest. Thousands of Chinese students and tourists lined the mall as President Xi Jinping sat in a horse-drawn carriage with the Queen and Prince Philip.
It's the nature of us to welcome our President of China.
Because we love China. Yeah, we love our country. Yeah, right.
What do you hope will come out of the visit?
I hope it can enlarge the relationship between China and the UK.
Britain is hoping for tens of billions of dollars in commercial deals from this visit, while the Chinese will see their leader being honoured in a most spectacular way. Sir Anthony Galsworthy is a former ambassador to China.
It will be seen as a mark that the leadership wishes to see a good relationship, a positive relationship with this country. And people in China will take that as a signal, so it will percolate right through the system. That's very positive, and it should help with a lot of the business that we have with China, whether it's financial, economic business or other business.
But Kate Allen from Amnesty International says money shouldn't blind British politicians to China's human rights record.
China is a country which executes more people than the rest of the world combined. It's a country where 245 lawyers have recently been arrested. Some of them have disappeared. We want our Prime Minister to raise those issues with the President of China and not simply talk about trade and take human rights off the table.
The Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, says everything is up for discussion.
The more deeply embedded we are in each other's economies, the more closely we work together, the more engaged we are with each other, the more opportunity there is to have a genuine discussion about these things, a frank discussion, not just megaphone diplomacy, but actually talking to each other and explaining our logic to each other. And we will certainly take the opportunity to raise issues which will be uncomfortable.
President Xi spoke of his hopes as he addressed the parliament.
Although my visit has just started, I am already deeply impressed by the vitality of China-UK relations and the profound friendship between our peoples. It is fair to say that China and the UK are increasingly interdependent and becoming a community of shared interests.
The Chinese president says he has good reason to believe the visit will lift the friendship to new heights, but the relationship faces more hurdles than simply human rights. The British steel industry is suffering, and thousands of sacked workers say cheap Chinese imports have created the problem.
Now, that was Lisa Miller reporting from London. The controversial Dutch politician Geert Wilders is in Perth this week to launch the Australian political party inspired by his own anti-Islamic party. The Australian Liberty Alliance is hoping to win at least one Senate seat at the next federal election by capitalizing on concerns around Islamic extremism. Terrorism experts say the party is preying on legitimate fears within the community to further its own political agenda. Lucy Martin has more.
The Australian Liberty Alliance says it's more than a one-policy party, but its stance on Islam is getting all the attention. The country's newest political party wants a ban on face coverings and a moratorium on visa applications from people living in Islamic countries. It's being launched in Perth tonight by controversial Dutch politician Geert Wilders. Party director Andrew Horwood says the venue is a secret due to concerns for his safety.
Geert Wilders has lived under 24-hour police protection for the last 10 years. He had an assassination attempt in Texas earlier this year, and this is just his life.
As the leader of the Dutch Party for Freedom, Mr. Wilders is known around the world for labelling Islam retarded and calling the Prophet Muhammad a paedophile. His party holds 12 out of 150 seats in the Netherlands Parliament. The Australian Liberty Alliance is hoping to replicate that success here by capitalising on local concerns over Islamic extremism. Benjamin Jones is a political historian at the University of Western Sydney.
In the mind of the Australian Liberty Alliance, Geert Wilders is the success story. However, they fail to acknowledge the huge differences between Australia, which has historically always been a nation of immigrants, at least since 1788, and Holland, which has not.
Dr. Jones says even those Australians who are concerned about elements of Islam are unlikely to vote for the ALA.
There is some legitimacy to Australians holding anti-Muslim attitudes. There was a 2011 study which said as high as 50%. But it's important to recognise that this is not a party that simply holds anti-Islamic views, but who are against multiculturalism writ large, which is something that the vast majority of Australians are actually very proud of, the great success that it's been.
Anne Arley is a counter-terrorism expert at Curtin University. She agrees the ALA's chances of success are low, but says they shouldn't be ignored.
I think we need to stop dismissing this underbelly of Australia and looking the other way. This is part of Australia and it needs to be addressed. We're not mature enough as Australians to have an open discussion about racism without it descending into name-calling and people becoming defensive about it. We need to talk about these things and we need to talk about them openly. And having groups like this actually gives us an opportunity to talk about it. Let's talk about what they want. Let's talk about their agenda. Let's talk about whether or not these myths that they are taught, that they are saying, this idea that there is actually even a remote possibility of the Islamification of Australia. Let's talk about how that is completely false.
The Premier, Colin Barnett, says Geert Wilders is not welcome in WA and has banned him from appearing at state government-owned venues. Mr Wilders will hold a press conference in Perth tomorrow to introduce the party's Senate candidates for the next federal election.
Australia's free trade agreement with China will go ahead after the Labor Party struck a deal with the government to get supporting legislation through Parliament. After previously raising concerns about the deal, the federal opposition says it's secured important safeguards for local and overseas workers. The government says the changes simplify enshrined existing policy into law. From Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
Labor's caucus held a special meeting this morning to sign off on the changes negotiated with the government to the free trade agreement. The ABC understands the debate was robust, with several MPs speaking against the deal. But in the end, caucus voted in favour.
It is a good day today because Labor, I believe, has secured, through constructive negotiation, through community concern, and through our good dialogue of sensible proposals, greater protections for Australian jobs.
The opposition leader Bill Shorten and Labor's trade spokeswoman Penny Wong announced the details.
We wanted to protect Australian wages and conditions and we wanted to uphold workplace skills and standards. And the package that we have agreed with the government delivers legal safeguards in these three areas. This is about Australian jobs. It is about a safety net of decent wages and conditions for all workers. And the outcomes we have received, we have achieved, will be legally binding.
The changes will be made via regulations, mostly to the Migration Act. That means no new bill has to go through Parliament, but the changes can be voted against or disallowed by Parliament within 15 sitting days. Labor says it's secured agreement in three major areas, which will apply in all circumstances and not just to the Chinese free trade deal. On major projects, employers will have to test the local market first. That is, they'll have to see whether there are Australians who can do the job before bringing in overseas workers under a migration work agreement. Temporary skilled workers on a 457 visa will have to be paid with reference to the enterprise bargaining agreement in force at a particular location and not just the award rate. And there'll be new visa conditions for overseas tradespeople to make sure they'll maintain a local licence. Senator Wong says the changes will mean policy becomes legally enforceable.
So what I'd say to you is we actually got three out of three. Three out of three legal changes to migration regulations to ensure legal obligations which are going to safeguard Australian jobs, wages and conditions and our licensing regime.
She's praised the Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, for his constructive approach to Labor's concerns, and in return he's thanked Labor for its bipartisan support.
The last few months has created confusion in China about just what is the attitude of Australians to our biggest trading partner. It has very wide implications, very important implications, and we're grateful that the opposition has properly recognised that issue as well.
Andrew Robb says the agreement with the opposition won't force any change to the deal signed with the Chinese government.
I've taken the opportunity to, you know, informally run some of it past them, and I've found that they were satisfied that it in no way altered what we'd agreed, and it didn't discriminate against them.
The Trade Minister says the government's also confident that the changes won't be an extra impost on business.
What it does do is provide an assurance to Labor, the Labor opposition in particular, that the requirements that have already been negotiated and agreed and are embodied in that agreement, that which the Labor Party has accepted and supported the agreement. They just want to make sure that some of the measures, particularly labour market testing, is not changed just by government fiat sometime in the future.
Once the supporting legislation gets through Parliament, the government hopes to finalise the free trade deal with an exchange of letters with the Chinese government by the end of this year.
Manus Island is Papua New Guinea's most isolated and least populated province. But, as PNG ABC correspondent Eric Tozek discovered when he went there to cover the trial of two men accused of killing an asylum seeker by the name of Reza Bharti at the Australian-run detention centre, Manus Island is now a place of suspicion, opportunism and injustice.
Journalists aren't really supposed to go to Manus Island. There's apparently a PNG government ban on travelling there. But if you go anyway, like I and other journalists have done, there's no hope of being inconspicuous. I was one of only two white men on the Air New Guinea flight, the only one carrying a news camera. The main hotel on the island puts on a bus from the airport. When I got on, the driver came over to me and said, "PNG migration officers are watching you. They want to know where you're going and what you're doing." I said, "I don't know you. I don't know what you're doing." That was good. The problem was, I didn't know what I was doing either. I'd left my tripod on the baggage cart, something I only realised when I got to the hotel. I was saved by a scary-looking PNG man who was wandering the walkways of the hotel looking for me. "Eric," he said, "did you bring my cord?" "Who the hell are you?" I thought, but said, "What cord?" instead. "My camera cord," he said. "I need to download the pictures from my camera's internal memory." It turns out this was Ruben Pokanow, a.k.a. Undercover, freelance journalist extraordinaire and Wontok, which means relative, to almost everyone on Manus Island. He's teasingly called Undercover by Manusians because he always claims to be filming secret stuff. I'm the opposite of Undercover. Like most people on this island, Ruben knew who I was and what I was there for. I gave him my spare camera cable and he steered me to the bar. "I need to get my tripod back," I said. "Relax, it'll be brought next door," he answered. "Don't I have to call someone or do something?" "You don't know the number, and there is no one there to answer," he said. "Just relax and wait." Amazingly, after about an hour, the tripod arrived next door, at a building I had thought was abandoned, but which turned out to be the Air New Guinea office. It was being unloaded right as Ruben and I walked up. "Good timing," Ruben said, grabbing the tripod and taking me back to the bar, where many more beers were put on my burgeoning tab. Ruben raised one. "Welcome to Manus Island," he said. The next morning I went to the courthouse to see if the murder trial was actually going to start. No one had been able to say for sure. As I walked through the gates, a man approached me and told me to put down my camera. He didn't look like a guard, but then again, neither do many of the guards in PNG. I introduced myself and he said his name was Chris. "You are covering the trial," he asked. "You want to talk to Josh and Louis?" Joshua Kaluvia and Louis Effi are the men accused of killing Iranian asylum seeker Reza Bharti. I'm not normally offered interviews with the defendants right before a trial, even though I knew they'd spoken to Guardian reporter Ben Doherty a few weeks before. I'd also been advised that I couldn't use the interview if the trial got underway. I will call Josh, Chris said regardless. He was aggressive and shifty. I decided to make excuses and explained that I was only allowed to report what was said in court, but Chris was undeterred. I have worked with other foreign journalists, he said. I will help you. Later, Chris rang me and I equivocated, citing the legal reasons. Eventually, he sent me a text. Sir, you will pay $1,000 to cover Josh and Louis Effie, he wrote, because we are going to use these funds to pay for their lawyer, to get their case rolling. They've been in jail for political reasons. I ignored the message and Chris became more insistent. Eventually, my lack of response pissed Chris off. We will put up a report to police to bar you from going in, he wrote. The media brings misery into their life for almost 2 years without any good fair justice. So we will bar you from going into the courthouse. I messaged Chris back and told him to relax and that I cared very much about their side of the story. Chris settled for just asking for money, lots of money, in increasingly insistent messages. I turned off my phone. The next day I went back to the court with my local colleague Wesley and Big Reuben. I pointed Chris out and Wesley asked people about him. They said he'd recently been a prisoner, so he'd probably been in jail with the defendants. But people told me he was looking for easy money and not to pay him. Someone also offered to beat him up for me. In the end, Reuben went over and had a word. I haven't received a text message since. The opening court sitting was delayed for a day, when the circuit judge, Justice Nicholas Kirawam, actually began calling for cases. It took little time for him to see that things on Manus were not working properly. I'm getting completely astounded, he exclaimed. This is totally unimaginable. The man he was yelling at was the local public solicitor, PNG's version of legal aid. But at that time, he was the one needing help. I think some of you will have to get reprimanded for not doing your job, Justice Kirawam said regretfully. Do you appreciate the importance of the office you are occupying? The public solicitor attempted an apology. Your worship, he stammered. Don't worship me, thundered Justice Kirawam, who was one of PNG's most senior judges. Do your job, he yelled. None of a long list of older charges, some dating back 15 years, are ready to be dealt with. This is because the public solicitor hadn't reviewed any of the files or made a note of his client's instructions. Justice Kirawam summarised neatly. You go and talk to people and you don't even write it down, he said. What is he saying about the charge? Is he admitting the charge? Where is his co-accused? Has he been dealt with? I don't know. No one else does either. The Manus Courthouse is a Besser Block box next to the dusty, potholed main road in Loringau, the only town. Local police divert traffic around the back while the court is sitting, so the sessions aren't drowned out by the noise of trucks working on the Australian-funded road upgrade. Here, justice seems slow as well as comical. After all his outrage, Justice Kirawam himself is not quite ready for some matters. When his turn comes to sentence, he makes each defendant stand up and, with impressive gravitas, tells them he will sentence them soon. I waited 3 more days for the murder trial to start. It then took 3 days to finish, and Justice Kirawam reserved his decision on whether the defendants are guilty. This means the case has been adjourned until the next circuit court on Manus Island in 2 months' time. Wes and I headed back to Port Moresby, but after we left Manus Island and the defendants were sent back to the small Loringau prison, we heard they wrote the judge a letter. They said they did not get a fair defence, as their court-appointed lawyer didn't call any witnesses other than themselves. I noted he also asked few questions, sometimes none, of the prosecution witnesses. Justice Kirawam has since granted the request to reopen the trial and continue the defence case. This may help ease some of the frustration felt on Manus Island about the trial. The families of the accused told us Joshua and Louis were getting railroaded. The court itself heard that other people were involved in the killing, but only Joshua and Louis have been charged. And with guys like Chris handling their fundraising, their chances of getting a better defence are limited. But sadly, it seems that's the reality of justice on Manus Island.
We now cut to the U.S. state of Florida. And you're probably saying to yourself, well, wait a second, the show is called Focus Asia Pacific, so why are you going to the U.S. state of Florida? Well, radio station WEBY is preparing a 10-hour documentary series on a very well-known radio station that was on the air in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. It, of course, is the Armed Forces Vietnam Network. People may remember that name because it was also featured in the movie about a well-known broadcaster who worked at the station by the name of Adrian Cronauer. Armed Forces Vietnam Network may no longer be on the air, but they do have a very interesting history. Mike Bates is one of the people behind the documentary.
From Saigon, this is the American Forces Vietnam Network, presenting Million Dollar Music for the Aquarian Age.
It went on the air in 1962, and it was in the Brink Hotel at the time. No, I'm sorry, it started out in the Rex Hotel, and then it moved to the Brink Hotel, but there was a bombing that destroyed the station, and they rebuilt it a few blocks from the embassy and had their own facility, and television was added as well, all under one roof at that time.
Now, the broadcasters that worked at the Armed Forces Vietnam Network, were they all U.S. military personnel, or did they also bring in commercial broadcasters from the U.S.?
The engineers were South Vietnamese engineers, technicians, if you will, who were very helpful in keeping the station running. But the station and the facilities were run by the U.S. military. The chief engineers and the official engineers were military, the newsmen were military, the announcers were military, the DJs were military. So there was plenty of assistance from South Vietnamese personnel, but the stations were run by the United States military, and it was servicemen that did the primary job at all these stations. And it wasn't just Saigon. There were as many as 8 affiliates throughout South Vietnam that carried the program that originated out of Saigon, plus some of them had their own locally originated program that they do for, you know, a handful of hours per day. But that's not to say that there were no well-known commercial voices on the program, because there were shows produced for Armed Forces Radio Television Service that were sent to Saigon and played. And the most memorable of those, at least from Vietnam, would be Chris Noel's program called A Date with Chris. And that was sent to Saigon and played throughout the entire network, and she was immensely popular among the servicemen in Vietnam.
There must, of course, have been some very interesting stories that you came across that were quite surprising when you were preparing this.
Well, one of the more interesting stories was told by Pat Sajak. Now, Pat Sajak hosts a game show here in the States called Wheel of Fortune. He's very well known for that. What he's less well known for is that in 1968 and 69, he was a DJ in Saigon with AFVN. He did the Dawn Buster show. This is the famous Good Morning Vietnam program that Adrian Cronauer is best known for doing, but Pat Sajak hosted that. Well, he told the story of one day when President Richard Nixon was delivering his first Christmas address to the nation as president. It was December of 1969, and Pat's instructions were, when the president comes on, break away from your music and put on the president. When the president's done, go back to your music. So Pat did that. He was monitoring the CBS feed, and when the CBS announcer said the president was coming, Pat turned off his microphone, introduced the president of the United States, and threw the switch to bring the CBS audio onto the air throughout all of South Vietnam on every AFVN station in the country. And the president delivered his standard, you know, peace, goodwill to men, standard Christmas remarks. And then he stopped talking. And so Pat Sajak turned the feed off, opened up his microphone, announced a song, and hit the turntable, and there comes the music. But then he was curious what the CBS commentators were saying about what Richard Nixon had just said. So he put the earphone from the CBS feed to his ear, and he hears Richard Nixon's voice saying, and now a special message for the Americans serving in Vietnam. And Pat tells the story. He's like, oh no, what do I do? And he says he's got the good devil on, or the good angel on one shoulder telling him to put the president on, and the bad devil on the other shoulder saying don't. And those went back and forth, and he said ultimately the bad devil won out on the theory that the only person on planet Earth that knows that Pat Sajak just made a mistake is Pat Sajak. And if he puts him on, everyone's going to know. So he never put the president on. And he told that story. And then I asked him, well, Pat, I know it's been almost 50 years, but would you like to introduce the president of the United States giving that message? And he got so excited. He said, you have that tape? Well, it was incredibly difficult for us to find that tape. The Nixon Library didn't have it. The National Archives didn't have it. The Television News Archives at Vanderbilt University didn't have it. It was nowhere to be found. So I pretty much gave up. We're not going to find it. Then one day I got a call from an archivist at the Nixon Library, and he says, Mike, we've been looking in the wrong place. Nixon had pre-recorded that message to the troops, and that's why it didn't appear in the transcripts, and that's why it didn't appear in our search for Christmas address, because he had pre-recorded that a couple weeks prior. But anyway, make a long story short, he said, if you pay to digitize this, I will send you a copy, because it was still on its original reel-to-reel tape at the Nixon Library. So I paid for it. About a week later, I got a CD, and we have that Nixon address, and we're going to play it. And for Vietnam veterans who were listening, it will be the first time ever that they've heard it.
Well, better late than never, as I suppose
exactly.
They say.
Exactly. Yeah. And Pat did introduce it, by the way. He cleared his throat and did a nice introduction.
How much of the Armed Forces Vietnam Network material has survived over the year? Because most of the programming, I take it, was done live.
Surprisingly little is still around. We do have a show that Pat Sajak did in 1969, and we are going to air that, but surprisingly few. We asked everybody that worked at AFVN who agreed to do an interview with us, do you have any recordings of your material? And almost everybody said no. It just wasn't done. And the reason that Harry Simons said he has so many tapes is that he thought what he was doing was unique, and he wanted his family back in the States to know what it was he was up to. So he recorded periodically, not every day, of course. In fact, it's a very small percentage of his work, but he recorded periodically his shows on reel-to-reel tapes, and he would mail them home to his family, and his family would listen to it. Well, his sister saved all those tapes, and they've been saved in an air-conditioned, which in Florida is a big deal, air-conditioned, climate-controlled environment. These things are pristine. The audio sounds like they were recorded 50 minutes ago, not 50 years ago.
And that was Mike Bates, one of the producers of that documentary series, that 10-hour documentary series. If you want to listen to it online and get more information, you can visit the website for WEBY at www.1330WEBY.com. Once again, www.1330WEBY.com. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Our email address, of course, is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team and ABC Radio National, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.